Good to be with you all. If we haven't met, I'm Rob, and it's an honor to be here and worship Christ together with you this morning. I want to welcome you if you're new. Glad that you're here with us this morning. Maybe it's your first Sunday. Maybe it's one of your first few Sundays. I hope you felt welcomed. I want to let you know if you want to connect or learn more about our church or hear about what's going on outside of Sunday mornings, we've got groups and classes and studies for men, women, and kids and all kinds of things. The best way to do that is stop by the blue connection tent that you'll see on our campus. It's over in between our worship center here and our learning center. And if you've been here for a while, if you've been here a while and you just want to know, hey, how do I get plugged into a group or a study? That's also the best place to go. So we'd encourage you to stop by there. If you want to know more about fellowship or how to get connected, you can also go to connect@fellowship.com. And then one last thing before we jump into God's word this morning is I just want to remind us it's an honor and privilege for us to give our gifts, for us to give. That's part of our worship. It's no obligation. I hope when you come here, you don't feel like, all right, here's the church dues announcement. That's not at all what this is about. This is just a part of our worship. And it's an overflow of our gratitude to God. And we get to be a part of what he's doing here and around the world through this. So I want to encourage you, several different ways you can give there on the screen. Now, open your Bibles to 1 John chapter 3. We're going to pick up the last two verses of chapter 2. We'll get to that. We're going to cover some verses in chapter 3 as we walk through this study. Now, earlier this week, I was walking through our offices, and right outside our conference room, which is over in the barn, we have this little table that's kind of set up where, you know, when we have drinks or food we need to manage, we kind of set that out there. And I saw something that was sitting on that table. It was this right here. It was this $20 bill. And I walked past it. I was like, okay, fill up somebody's pocket. I'm going to see how long it sits there. You know, we got offices of pastors all around. Let's see how long the $20 bill sits there. Sure enough, you all, you'd be proud. It sat there most of the week. In fact, it's kept sitting there. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know if anyone's going to claim this. Maybe I should claim it. And then I thought, no, I'll put it in the offering. I'll put it in the offering box. That's what I'll do. And so I picked it up. And as I picked it up, kind of something caught my eye. I'll put a picture on the screen of this particular $20 bill. It takes you a moment, doesn't it? You're so used to seeing a $20 bill. You're like, wait a second, something's not quite right. The first thing that I saw was on the backside, motion, picture, purposes. And then underneath, in props, we trust. And I was like, no, this is sacrilege, you know? And now I started thinking about it more. And I was like, well, what I really want them to say, in God we trust, if it's fake, you know, I don't know that I want them to say that. But anyway, so it's obvious that they're trying to make it look like the real thing, but they know they can't fully make it look like the real thing, or there's going to be trouble. Now, you know, if you want to come look at it in person, I'll have it up here afterward. It's remarkable how it feels, how it looks. I mean, you know, you don't know, and that's the point. It looks exactly like the real thing. Now, I was thinking about this week. And by the way, when I figured this out, I showed it to Lloyd, and then we're like, what are we going to do with it? I guess you just throw it away. Now that felt weird because it just feels weird to throw away money, but you're like, it's not money. It's just a piece of paper. So Lloyd threw it away. And then later on, I was driving home and I thought, I'm going to use this as a sermon illustration on Sunday. So Lloyd dug it out of the trash. It had coffee stains all over it. And here it is right here. So if you want to come look, it's down here at the front. Now, John is writing in this letter to a culture where for the first time, there are counterfeit Christians out there. For the very first time in history, there are people that are saying we're Christians that John is saying, oh no, that what they believe and who they're following is not Jesus. And John's saying, I know because I was with Jesus. Now, Lloyd talked about this last week. A group of people had broken off from the church and were teaching a different gospel. But it was deceptive because they were saying, we have the real truth. They were saying, we're the real Christians. You see, they were counterfeit Christians in this culture. So a major focus of the letter of 1 John is helping the church tell the difference between real Christianity and the counterfeit or the false gospel that was starting to spread in John's day. Now, you might know this already, but this is something that I learned. If you want to identify counterfeit money, you don't study the counterfeit. You study the real thing. The more you know the real thing, the more you become an expert on the real thing, the more easily you can spot the counterfeits. That's how this works. So a major focus for John is the real thing of the gospel. All throughout his letter, he's talking about, here's what it really means. Here's what it really looks like to be a Christian. Now think about how valuable this is for us in our time and place, because unlike in John's culture, we live in a culture where there's tons of Christians. In John's culture, very few people had even heard about Jesus. In our culture, it's like, oh, Christianity, that's old hat. In fact, we live in a time and place where the vast majority of people around us would claim to be a Christian. Now, there's a growing number that would say, I don't claim to be anything, but still, the majority of people where we live, and even studies show in our country at large, would claim to be a Christian. But if you were to drill down on what they mean by I'm a Christian, you're going to hear a lot of different things, aren't you? Even more, if you could examine their lives and I'm talking about like what motivates them and how they spend their time and what they value and what they worry about, I think most often you'd find very little in common with the followers of Jesus in the New Testament. So what does this mean? Well, for starters, I think it's a very interesting time and place to be a Christian. I personally believe most people who say they're part of the Christian faith and genuinely believe they're part of the Christian faith, I think most have not actually experienced the rebirth Jesus talked about. They've not been regenerated, to use a theological word. And here's what this means. They're not actually in Christ, and Christ is not actually in them. So here's the question I want us to wrestle with this morning in our text. In a world where so many people claim to be Christians, how do you know what's real? So this is why I think 1 John is such an important book for us in our time and place. And honestly, this passage in particular, because it helps us know what real Christianity is. Now, as we walk through this, I want to press in and encourage you not just to think about your neighbors and your family members and the people out there in the culture. I want to encourage you to think about yourself. I want to encourage you to ask the question, do I know that I know that I have a real relationship with God? How do I know that God is in me? In our passage, John gives three characteristics of the real thing. And here they are on the screen. Real wonder, real hope, real transformation. These are three things real Christians possess. Another way to say it, real Christianity is wonderful, hopeful, transformational. In other words, it's full of wonder, it's full of hope, and it leads to real transformation. So wonder, hope, and transformation, three signs that you have the real thing. We're going to talk about each. We'll start with wonder. Real Christianity is full of real wonder. Let's look at chapter 3, verse 1. Well, by the way, we'll come back to the closing two verses of chapter 2 at the end, and you'll see why. See what kind of love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God, and so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Now, it may not seem at first like this verse has a whole lot to do with wonder, but it really does. In fact, the first sentence of John chapter 3 is one of the high points of John's letter. I believe it's one of the high points of the whole New Testament. But it's hard to capture the wonder in the translation. In the English translation, it's hard to sort of get the emotion that I think John was both feeling and wanting to evoke through his words. So let's talk about the words a little bit. I'm going to mark this up so that you can kind of see some things. The first word that I want to talk about is the word see. Now, in the Greek, it's not the idea of just sort of noticing something. It's the idea of taking notice of something, of really seeing something, of stopping and staring at something. So I like the way that some older English translations translate this word. I think it's helpful. It's an older word, but it captures the idea better. It's like stop and stare. It's like behold. And even I'd put an exclamation point after it because I think that's the emphasis of it. It's the first word in this sentence. It's being emphasized. Now, I want to talk about these words here. Now, these words here translate one Greek word that is an idiom. Now, idioms are notoriously hard to move from one language to another. So think about one of our idioms. It's raining cats and dogs. If you were to translate that into Japanese, it literally, they would be think you're crazy, right? So you have to find a different word or a different idiom in the language to translate it. The idiom in Hebrew is very interesting. It literally means this: from what country? The idea here is John is saying there's something foreign to us. There's something that we don't recognize. From what country is this? Like, it must be something that's not from here because it's so unfamiliar. And what is he talking about? The love of the Father. From what country is this love? Where did it come from? It's foreign to us. Now, there's one other word that will kind of help us. It's this word given. It's the idea of an extravagant gift that's offered. I like the way the NIV translates this. They say it this way, that this gift is lavished on us. So put all this together. You have something like this. Behold, from what country is this kind of love the Father has lavished on us? You start to hear the wonder in this. This is what John is feeling and what he's expressing. Another way I might say it, like a little more of a paraphrase, is stop and stare at this extraordinary love, this otherworldly kind of love. Where did it come from? It's the love the Father has freely given us. Do you hear the wonder in this? Now, John's having a moment here. He's writing this letter and he sort of interrupts his own train of thought and he just says, stop and stare. Behold. Now, what is he so excited about? Well, it's the love of the Father, but he goes on, right? He's not done. And here's what he says is really particularly grabbing his attention. Here's what I'm beholding, this idea that we should be called children of God. There's the truth that causes John to burst out, that causes him to say, behold, take a look at this. Now, this is where I think it helps to remember John's an old man at this stage of his life. He started following Jesus as a young teenager. When he's writing this letter, he might be near 90. You know, he's likely at least in his 80s. You think about how long he's been a follower of Jesus, and he's still astonished by this. This is real wonder. John is marveling over the truth of the gospel. And I think it's something he's saying that once you get it, you don't ever fully recover from it. And here's the core truth. You've become a child of God. Now, you might be thinking, isn't everyone a child of God? Doesn't God love all of us, his creation, his people? And the answer is yes and no. Yes, he does love all his people. And yes, he's the creator of everyone. But that's not the kind of child-parent relationship John is getting after here. John is talking about a more particular kind of relationship. He's saying, you didn't used to be this, and now you are. In other words, you've been brought into God's family. In other words, you've been adopted in. You've been adopted into God's own family. Look at John 1, 10 through 12. This is the gospel of John now. We've looked at this verse before. He was in the world, talking about Jesus. The world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Let's talk about that word. Right. The whole point of adoption, you all, is the adopted child gets all the rights and all the privileges of being a real member of the family. So what John is saying here in John chapter 1 is he's saying there was a time that you were not, and then there's a time that you are. And what brought you in was receiving Jesus. All who received him, who believed in his name, you got the right. You were brought into the immediate family. Now I want you just to stop and behold. Stop and think about this. If you've received Christ, this means you have the same access to the Father as the only begotten Son. Like, that's the whole point of adoption. Adopted children don't have any less rights than biological children. Legally, you have the same access to the Father, even more amazing, you all. John chapter 17 tells us that the same love the Father has for his only begotten Son, he loves you that same way. He loves you the same. You have the same access. He loves you the same. That means you're in the family, you see. Now, let's talk a little more about adoption, because I think there's something here for us. Those of you that have been around fellowship a long time, you know adoption ministry is a big deal. It's a part of our DNA. In fact, if you get to know a number of families at fellowship, you're going to find dozens of amazing adoption stories. Several years ago, I officiated the wedding ceremony of Robbie and Nicole Casper, who attend our church here. And then earlier this year, they reached out and they said, we're hoping to adopt. We'd love to adopt. God's put this on our heart. We don't have the funds to do it. And so we had a conversation with them. Marty Sweeterman, our pastor of family ministry, met with them, and we were able to come alongside through our I Choose You Fund. Many of you don't even know about this. This is some money that is just set aside. We don't touch it. It's been given by people in this body. It's specifically for families at Fellowship who are hoping to adopt. And so we were able to come alongside Robbie and Nicole in this journey and be a significant part of that. Fast forward, last Saturday, like just over a week ago, I got to attend the welcome home celebration for their adopted son, Ezra James Casper. I want to show you this picture of this family. Now, I stood on the back porch and listened to Robbie and Nicole share the story of traveling down to where he was born, going to the hospital, experiencing all the hopes and dreams and anxieties and emotional roller coasters that come with these adoptions. Many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. But at the end of it all, there was a moment in time when little Ezra was legally made a part of their family. And this is the amazing moment. It's like 1 minute, he's not part of their family. The next minute, he is, and he will never be taken away. Now, because of his adoption, Ezra has the full parental love of this couple. It is now his by right. I want to show you one more photo. This is the community of friends and family that were there to celebrate Ezra's homecoming. They came from all over the country. Now, can you spot him down there? He's right in the middle of the attention. At this point in his life, there is no way he can comprehend the significance of this photo. He is at the very center of a community of love that he had no access to, and now he's in it. It is his by rights, you see. Do you see the wonder of that? Now, here's the question for you. Can you put yourself in this picture? Not as one of the people around supporting, but as the little guy who is now surrounded by the community of love. He's now in the family. This is the extraordinary kind of love John is talking about that's made available to you, but it must be received. According to John, when you receive Jesus, you're given the right to be a child of God. If you can put yourself in this picture, then you know the wonder John is writing about. And that's a sign. That's a sign that you've been reborn. I feel a taste of that wonder. I feel a bit of it. Even this morning, maybe. Maybe you've forgotten it. You've sort of lost it. Even this morning, it's being rekindled in you. That's a sign that you've been reborn. You know, Joe, go ahead and take this photo off the screen, if you will. Here's what I want to say about this, you all. People who are simply religious or people who are simply moralistic don't experience that. They don't have a sense of wonder of, oh, I'm in. Now, what they might have is a sense of, I hope I'm in. I think I'm in. I know I'm better than most people. And what's actually going down in their heart is they think, I think I deserve to be in. You see, that's not the gospel. That's not real Christianity. Real Christians know the wonder. Real Christians have this sense that by no means am I deserving of this at all, but love of God has invaded me. I know, I'm in, you see. I don't deserve it. It's invaded me, and I can't get over it. Real wonder, that's the first sign, real wonder. The second sign is real hope. Let's go back to our text. Let's look at the next two verses. Beloved, now let me just pause right there and remind us, beloved means loved ones. Do you see how he's connecting back to what he just said? Loved ones, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure. This is fascinating. John is saying, as amazing as it is right now to be God's children, we have an even greater hope. In other words, there's something still to come in our future that is so incredible that we don't even know what it is. We can't even describe it yet because it hasn't appeared. It hasn't been revealed. We can't fully comprehend it. Now, what is it? What is our hope that John is so excited about? We'll come back to that. Pause that. I first want to talk about the simple fact of how counterintuitive it is to have real hope in our culture today. We live in a culture that's lost the belief that there's anything in the future worth getting excited about. Polls have shown this over and over, in recent years especially. As a people, we are pessimistic about the future. Now, it's a serious thing, you all, when a culture begins to lose hope. Historically, here's what you start to see. When a culture starts losing hope in the future, you start seeing these things. Social fragmentation, increased individualism, economic decline, moral decay, political instability, the rise of tribalism, widening inequality. Does this sound familiar at all? You know, this is historically what you see when you look at cultures. Now, here's what I want to drill down on. This is really fascinating to me. Historically, in this type of political climate and this type of cultural climate is a better way to say it. When a society is losing hope that there's anything good to look forward to in the future. When that happens, real Christians have always historically stood out. Why is that? Because they have the answers to fix society's woes? Mostly not. Mostly it's because they have real hope. Now, what is the Christian's hope resting on? Is that we're going to turn this thing around collectively and we're going to be more flourishing as a society, as a community than we've ever been before? No, that's not the source of hope. As an aside, that doesn't mean we shouldn't work for the flourishing of our society under God. I'm not saying that at all, but I'm pointing out what John is saying. Our actual real hope is the fact that there's something greater, that there's something far beyond what we could imagine. In fact, that there's no prosperous or flourishing human society that can compare to what the future holds for us. What is the real hope of the Christian? John described it this way, that when he appears, we shall be like him because we shall see him as he is. The hope of the Christian is when he appears. And why is that so hopeful? We'll see him as he is. Now, I bet you that doesn't make your heart beat as much as John intended. You'll see him as he is. There's something incredible going on here. I almost don't even know how to describe it. I don't actually have the words to explain what I think John is getting after here. But let me just say this. It's far more than your curiosity being satisfied about what God looks like. There will be something that will happen in you when you see God face to face. And it says in that moment, you're going to become like him. You're going to become like him because you'll see him as he is. Now, let me just do my best to try to spark a little bit of something in us this morning. Consider this. Have you ever seen something so beautiful you could hardly take your eyes off of it? Have you ever had a desire so captivating you couldn't stop thinking about it? Have you ever tasted something so delicious that you thought, I don't want this meal to end? Have you ever had an experience so enjoyable and so fulfilling that you wished it could go on forever and ever? Now think about this. Everything you've ever loved in life is derivative of God. It's all derivative. It's all created by a source. every pleasure, every desire, every good and beautiful thing is but a mere creation, you see. It's like sparks of light emanating from the star himself. This is exactly what James was talking about in James 1:17. He says, every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of heavenly lights, in whom there is no variation or shadow. So in our verse, John is saying, for the real Christian, there will be a moment in your future where you will gaze directly into the source of everything you've ever loved. The place where all the good things you've ever tasted emanate from, and you'll see it. You'll experience it in fullness. You'll be brought in, you see. Here's how Paul described this same moment in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. You could just as well say, now I taste good things in part, then I shall know them fully. Now I think I know God, then I'll know him, even as I have been fully known by him, you see. Now, this is such a remarkable thing. Like, I don't remember studying this in seminary. And, you know, I do some research on this. Sure enough, theologians have been writing about this for centuries. It has a Latin name. Some of you may have heard this. I wasn't very familiar with it. It's called the beatific vision. Now, that's Latin. Beatific comes from beatus, which means happy. This is the thing you'll see that will make you happy. The beatific vision, the happy thing you'll see, it's the face of God, it's God himself. I want to show you how the artist Gustave Doré imagined what this might possibly be like. To look God eye to eye will be the moment all your desires are fulfilled. Your desire to be loved, your desire to be approved of, your desire for security and comfort. Your desire to be swept up in a great adventure. In other words, your greatest desires here, but small tastes of what is to come. We experience our desires right now in frustratingly incomplete ways, in frustratingly broken ways. They're never fully satisfied, not in whole, and certainly never all at once. The real hope for Christians is that what lies ahead for us in death and beyond is by no means the loss of any true desire, but rather the fulfillment of all of them. So there's another sign. Do you know real hope? Does this stir anything in you? So two signs so far. Have you experienced real wonder? Did you experience real hope? There's one more. Real transformation. Now, this next section, verse 4 to 10, is long and it's dense. I'm going to read it, and then I'll do my best to explain what I believe John is saying in this. Everyone who makes a practice of sinning also practices lawlessness. Sin is lawlessness. You know that he appeared in order to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. No one who abides in him keeps on sinning. No one who keeps on sinning has either seen him or known him. Little children, let no one deceive you. Whoever practices righteousness is righteous, as he is righteous. Whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil has been sinning from the beginning. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. No one born of God makes a practice of sinning, for God's seed abides in him, and he cannot keep on sinning because he's been born of God. By this it is evident who are the children of God and who are the children of the devil. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is the one who does not love his brother. Oh boy. Oh my. If you're paying attention to that, you're like, oh, okay, maybe the first two signs, I can see some of that in me. And this third sign, I'm not so sure about. Now, there's obviously a lot here. The first question we have to wrestle with is, does this mean real Christians do not sin? Because it seems to say that. I want to answer that question by looking at John's own words from the same letter in the previous chapter. Look at 1 John 1, 8-9. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. My little children, I'm writing these things to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. So John clearly does not believe that when you become a real Christian, when you truly receive Christ, you stop sinning. He clearly does not believe that. So what is he talking about in our text? Let's go back to our text this morning. Now, there's something that you have to understand. You really see it in the original language when you look at it. It starts with this. Let's talk about his definition of sin. Sin is lawlessness. Now, what is lawlessness? I think that's a great translation of the Greek word. It means behaving in defiance to the law. Now, there's a similar English word that I think is helpful here to lawlessness. It's the word anarchy. Now, that seems extreme, but let me explain. Anarchy is choosing to live outside of any accepted authority. An anarchist would say, I don't think anyone or anything has the right to put any governing structure over me, you see. Now, let me show you something else. With that in mind, I want you to see, hopefully you noticed as I read it through, three times John uses this phrase, makes a practice of sinning. It's there in verse 4, it's down in verse 8, and then it's also in verse 9. I'm gonna geek out on you for a minute. John is using a present active participle. Here's why that matters. It means action that's continuous and ongoing. It's like it doesn't stop. It just keeps on going on. This is grammatically what he's trying to say. Now, three additional times, let me use a different color here. John is using another phrase, and this phrase is keeps on sinning. It's twice in verse 6, keeps on sinning, keeps on sinning. And then it's again in verse 9, cannot keep on sinning. Those are present active indicative verbs, which means continuous action, habitual action. Now, put all this together. Grammatically, this just jumps off the page in the Greek. It's kind of obscured in the English, although I think ESV is doing a pretty good job here. Makes a practice of, keeps on. That's why they're saying it that way. Put this together. What is John saying? Here's a sign that God lives in you when you're no longer continually resisting his authority. When you've come in from the anarchy, you've come in from the rebellion. Now, this is a transformation in you that happens when you're regenerated. Whether you believe it or not, you were not born wanting to be under God's authority. And some of you think back in your life, well, I was always good. You know, I always believed in God. I was always obeying God. Oh, there's more going on in your heart. Trust me, a lot more going on in my heart. None of us are born wanting to be under God's authority. We're born wanting to be our own God, wanting to be our own authority. Our old nature does not willingly come under God's authority. But when you become alive in Christ, a true transformation takes place. The Bible calls it a new birth. And although you may from time to time revert back to old practices, you have a new nature that desires to live under God and with God rather than against him. Here's maybe how you might understand this. A sign that you have God in you is when you desire to obey him, even if you're struggling to do so, but you're thinking, I don't always desire to obey him. You have an advocate, Jesus Christ. This is what John has already talked about. Now, I really love the way N.T. Wright summarized this. I'm going to put this quote on the screen. We are playing a different piece of music now. And even if our fingers slip sometimes and play some wrong notes, notes that belong to the music we used to play, that doesn't mean we are going back to play that old music for real once more. When you find yourself playing a different type of music, in other words, when you find yourself desiring to obey God, that's a sign he's in you. John's point is once he's in you, real transformation is not only possible, it's inevitable. It will happen. How is that? Look again at verse 9. No one born of God makes a practice of sinning, for God's seed abides in him, and he cannot keep on sinning because he has been born of God. God's seed abides, lives, dwells, takes up residence in you. What's inside a seed? The life of whatever the plant is. Inside a sunflower is the life of a sunflower. Inside an apple tree or inside an apple seed is the life of an apple tree. Inside a God seed is the life of God himself. If you've been born of God, John says, God abides in you like a seed. Do you think that seed can be contained? If it's planted in you, he will transform you from the inside out. Now, you might say, but you don't know what I've done. You don't know what I've been doing recently. You don't know how hard my heart is toward God. You don't know how angry I am at him. And God would say back to you, you don't know the power of my seed in you. Let me show you an image of what it might look like in your life right now. If God's seed is in you, it will break through the strongest rock of the hardest heart. So from time to time, when after I'm done teaching, I'll have someone come down and they kind of have this posture of, I don't belong here. I don't belong here. And they'll come and say, tell me, how are you? What's going on? And they'll just say, well, I believe in Jesus, but I haven't been to church in a really long time. I'm kind of coming in from the cold, and I'm not sure God accepts me. You know, and they'll go on and tell me their story a little bit. I think about this image. I think about the very fact that they're here, you all, is a sign. It's life breaking through a hard heart. Do you see? The very fact that you're here. Now, I know not all of you are here in faith, but many of you are. Many of you are like, I'm not even sure Jesus would have any conversation with me, but you're here. You're here. If God's seed is in you, it'll break through the strongest rock of the hardest heart. Now, the gospel is full of wonder. The gospel is full of hope. And the gospel will bring about real transformation in you. And I want to invite you now to the table. I want to encourage you to take out your communion elements, and I'll invite the band to come back out. And as we prepare for communion, I want to put two more verses on the screen that we'll reflect on for just a moment. These are the two verses that I skipped over at the beginning. They're the last two verses of chapter 2. And now, little children, abide in him, so that when he appears, we may have confidence and not shrink from him in shame at his coming. If you know that he is righteous, you may be sure that everyone who practices righteousness has been born of him. Now, why did I save these two verses for this moment? Because what we are about to do together, you all, is to practice righteousness. Now, what do you mean by that? How is this practicing righteousness? What does it even mean to practice righteousness? To obey Jesus. We are about to celebrate the Lord's table in obedience to Jesus. Jesus asked us to do this. Jesus commanded us that we remember him. Why was this so important to him? Because he knows belief in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus is that seed that once it takes root, it will transform us from the inside out. He's saying, put your attention on this. Let me transform you from the inside out as you practice righteousness. Now, it says, if you know he is righteous, don't we know he is righteous? Well, for some of you in the room, you're not sure this morning if you have the real thing. Here's your invitation. Abide in him. Make your home in him. Come in. The door has been opened by Christ through his life, through his death, through his resurrection. That's an open door. The question is, will you walk in? and you walk in by faith. Jesus is love come to earth, and he wants to bring you into the family of God. He wants to adopt you in. Have you received that otherworldly kind of love? You can do so in this moment. You just simply talk to God and just say, I behold it. I see the wonder of it. I have the hope of it. I want to be transformed by it. I put my trust in him. I put my trust in Christ. And if that's your posture this morning, welcome to the family. To all who receive him, who believe in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. This bread and this cup are reminders to us of the otherworldly love of the Father made available to us through the Son, through his body and his blood. Let's receive the bread. And let's receive the cup. See what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God. For that is what we are. The extraordinary love of God has given us real wonder, real hope, and real transformation. We get to worship him because of that. We get to respond. And so that's why we're going to sing this last song. I want to encourage you to stand to your feet. We're going to celebrate this together and sing about the hope we have in him. Jesus Christ, our living hope.